So we have Paul Kellogg here. He's going to speak on Lenin, Democrat or dictator. And he's editor of The Socialist Worker.
What is
Oh, yeah, okay. I guess how long?
About half an hour.
Okay, we'll talk for about half an hour, and then I guess we'll have a discussion for about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll have Paul conclude after.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I'm very glad to be here to give this meeting, and I'm very impressed. I understand this is the last day of classes, and there must be something special going on at Carleton, where in the last day of classes, people gather around a table to talk about Lenin. I mean, this is not Carleton's usual reputation, but that's okay. You know, reputations can always improve, so that's good. Every generation that challenges capitalism in the last through the 20th century into the 21st century discusses Lenin. Lenin is an issue for every round of radicalization. Not so much because, now why is Lenin important? Let's put this in a little bit of context. Lenin as an individual is only a person of interest because of the Russian Revolution and the role that he played in the Russian Revolution. And regardless of what anyone's analysis of Lenin is, or anyone's analysis of what happened in Russia is, it has to be said that in Russia in 1917, that moment of history was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary moment, and the party that Lenin was a leader of, the Bolshevik Party, played a central role, and Lenin as an individual played a central role. I mean, it was an extraordinary moment. It is worth simply saying a couple of things about that moment. It was a revolutionary upsurge in one of the most oppressive countries in the world that overthrew the Tsar. In February of 1917, the Tsar was forced to abdicate. And there's no question that the February 1917 revolution, the revolution happened in two waves, was a mass popular upsurge. It was hundreds of thousands, millions of people taking action against oppression, against the Tsar, in a way that it surprised everybody. It surprised Lenin. Lenin, about 6 months prior to this, had said, he was in exile, giving a lecture in Switzerland, and he said to young people, he said, you know, we have a dream of socialism, a dream of revolution. Myself and my friends in the older generations, we won't live to see that, but maybe you will. And 6 months later, Russia is in turmoil. There are Soviet workers' councils, which I'll talk about more later, playing an absolutely central role in the event, springing up mass organs of mass democracy, etc., ousting the Tsar. It also is a revolution that was the beginning of the factors that ended World War I. That terrible, terrible, terrible slaughter that might have gone on for years had it not been for the intervention of the masses, that ultimately ended the war in the Eastern Front, beginning the process of ending the war 1 year later in 1918. And now, what I've just said about the February Revolution, many, many people would agree roughly with that description. Maybe differ in details, but there's, you know, that story. The October Revolution is more controversial. In October, February, it was a very spontaneous upsurge, spontaneous to the extent that all the existing left parties opposed it at first. They thought it was premature. They thought, no, it was International Women's Day. There was a demonstration. The women were demonstrating for bread, and they wanted to call on the textile workers to go on strike in support of them. And all of the left parties, including Lenin's party, the Bolshevik party, said, don't do this. There will be police repression. We're not strong enough. Premature, the women said, well, we don't care. We're doing it anyway because we want bread. They demonstrated, and the response was extraordinary. The entire working class went on a strike. It surprised everyone. It forced the left. The political consciousness of the masses was ahead of where the left was. The left had to run to catch up. October's more controversial. October, where the Bolsheviks ended up as the party in power, although that's not exactly an accurate description of what happened, but it's usually the way it's portrayed, is usually seen as a coup d'etat. It's usually seen as a coup by a minority, whereas February was the mass movement moving up, October was a movement of a minority. I don't think that's accurate. It looked like a movement of a minority because the regime that it was overturning was so weak. It had, in St. Petersburg, in particular, it had the appearance of a strict military operation, of a very, very organized takeover of the radio stations, takeover of the central places, etc. It was more chaotic elsewhere. But to give you a sense of the extent to which it was also a mass movement, a mass revolution, I'll quote the words of John Reed as it's quoted in this book, this very interesting book by Marcel Liebman called Leninism Under Lenin. A couple of weeks after what was called a coup d'etat happened, a general named Krasnov tried to go back to the capital to reconquer power, organized an army, a counter-revolutionary army, to try to go back to St. Petersburg to counter power. The entire population of the working class population of St. Petersburg moved out of the city armed in a chaotic formation, but by their hundreds of thousands to oppose Krasnov. It was an unbelievable. John Reed watched the tens of thousands of workers leaving the factories for the front. They rolled along torrent-like, and if you haven't read John Reed's book, 10 Days That Shook the World, you should read it. It's a beautiful book. The Revolutionary Proletariat Defending with Its Breast the Capital, the Workers' and Peasants' Republic. An extraordinary sight into the night, into the evening, into the next day. The plains in front of St. Petersburg filled with hundreds of thousands of workers. Krasnov could not move forward. The counter-revolution was defeated. In other words, October was also a movement of the masses. Now, that's why Lenin's important, because that event was important. That event, what happened in Russia in 1917 is important, and he played a central role. Now, through the 20th century, there were two views about Lenin that dominated. On the right, and there are many, many people on the right who studied Lenin, they portrayed it as follows. The Russian Revolution happened led by Lenin. That led logically to the rise of the dictatorship under Stalin, one of the most bloodthirsty dictatorships in world history, millions of people dying in the concentration camps. Lenin led directly to Stalin. It's all one big, horrible mess. Lenin led to Stalin. That is the essential right-wing view that comes from the right. On the left, as part of the part of the Cold War, on the left, there was the opposite version. In a certain sense, and this wouldn't be too crude a thing to say, Lenin was portrayed as a devil. A devil who had conjured up forces that led to barbarism and totalitarianism. On the left, the majority view was sort of the mirror image of that. Lenin wasn't a devil. Lenin was a saint. Leading to the most awful things, such as Lenin's body being preserved and kept in a mausoleum in Red Square for people to go and view, like going to the body of a pharaoh being preserved in the pyramids, his brain being taken out and pickled and preserved and studied by scientists. I mean, these are appalling things. These are ridiculous things. These are things that make my skin crawl. It's an appalling, and that was sort of the debate. The debate in the 20th century in its biggest forms was that. I'm not going to look at those two extremes. There is a more interesting discussion of Lenin that has emerged in the 60s, in the new left of the 60s. It has emerged now in the wake of the anti-capitalist movement from Chiapas in 1994 to Seattle in 1999, in the anti-war movement, the new left that's emerged around that, about Lenin. And it's more sophisticated. It says something like the following, that yes, Lenin was a person of the left. Yes, the Russian Revolution was an important event, but it got into problems because of some aspects of Lenin's politics. Two in particular. Number one, that Lenin's way of organizing the party was hierarchical and top-down. It was undemocratic. It was too tightly controlled. The Central Committee controlled the party, and one individual controlled the Central Committee. This is just too hierarchical. That contains within it the seeds of dictatorship. Number two, the state that emerged then out of this party, even though it began in a very democratic way, in the way that I've described, the mass upsurge from below, creating beautiful, beautiful, beautiful institutions of workers' power, these incredible, they were called Soviets, which is workers' councils. There were also factory committees inside the workplaces. There were councils of every sort, everywhere for the society, that eventually this top-down party strangled it. And it became a one-party state, where maybe it might have been called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, but in fact it was a monolithic state led by dominated by the Communist Party. That is the view I'm going to look at. That's the one I'm going to critique and look at, because I think that it I want to examine this view as a Marxist. And the essence of Marxism is really historical materialism. I want to place Lenin and his writings and his work in their historical context, in the context of the social, economic, political, historical context in which it developed. Look at those two views, views of the party organization, view of the state, and the third part, look at what the implications are for today. And very briefly, what does it mean to say historical materialism? Marx summarized it brilliantly. At one point he said, human beings, the German is usually translated into English as men make their own history. I think it could be easily translated as humans make their own history, whatever. In the 21st century, humans make their own history, but not under conditions of their own choosing. The past weighs like a nightmare upon the brains of the living. Another way of putting it, there's a realm of freedom. We make our own history, but there's also a realm of necessity. We do it under certain constraints. The economy being the most fundamental. If the economy is very poor, there's very little you can do. If the economy is very rich, there's more you can do. There are other constraints as well, etc. All right. Using that method, let's turn to the first issue being one of party organization. There are many different components that are important to pull out of an examination of the extraordinary political institution, which was the Bolshevik Party, which came into existence in 1903 as a product of a split inside the existing left in Russia and played a central role in the Russian Revolution of 1917. Here's a couple that are extraordinarily important. One, it was the first time in the Western European socialist and Marxist movement had existed for some decades, but this was really the first time where the revolutionary wing, the most left wing of the what was called then the social democratic movement, it made it, social democracy meant something different than it did today, organized separately. The Bolsheviks were the left. There had been a united party, the RSDLP, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. The Bolsheviks were its left wing. Essentially, they, from 1903 on, although the history is complicated, essentially they organized independently. They organized separately from the more moderate wing, the more conservative wing of the party. This is the first time that it happened. The second component of party organization that was extraordinarily interesting, this was a very left-wing group. I mean, Lenin studied he said, we will have to overthrow capitalism, that will take a revolution, this revolution will involve arms, it will not happen peacefully, it's impossible. I mean, it's left-wing, but the way in which the party organized, oftentimes in politics, you feel like you have to make a choice. Either I'll be left-wing, with all this left-wing stuff, revolution, etc., or I'll be effective. I'll involve myself in the fight for better wages, the fight for health care, the fight for women's rights, etc. The Bolshevik Party, from its origins, combined both with a method that came to be called the United Front Method, saying fighting for reforms with revolutionary methods. Not only take seriously the fight for reforms, in a certain sense, in most hours of the day, in most days of the week, in most months of the year, the fight for reforms is what you do. You're fighting for better wages, you're fighting in the trade unions, you're fighting for women's rights, you're fighting against the repressive divorce laws, you're fighting against the persecution of Jews in Russia, it's a very anti-Semitic society, etc. You're fighting on all these fronts. You're fighting for abortion rights. It's very interesting. One of the first moments in history where a party emerges fighting for the right of women to abortion is the Bolshevik Party in that period of time. But you link that fight to the ultimate need for a revolution. You combine the two together, United Front Method. Those are not usually the aspects of Lenin's party organizing that are focused on. What are focused on are the fact that he wrote a book in 1903, What Is to Be Done, where he says the key component of the party is professional revolutionaries, people who are devoted 100% to the party. That's the key to the party. They're paid professional revolutionaries. Secondly, that it's a hierarchical party. And actually, if you read through What Is to Be Done, he talks about the necessity for a centralized organization, a centralized party, where there's real discipline, real, in a certain sense, a monolithic party. It has a very top-down feel to it. Oftentimes, that is called democratic centralism. The term that is used to describe that, I think that's probably a very widely known term, democratic centralism, to describe Lenin's party organization. This opens up an interesting question. Let's take the term democratic centralism. The term does not get used in 1903. Lenin wrote What Is to Be Done. The first time the term democratic centralism gets used is in 1906. It's introduced by Lenin. It's in a party congress, the details of which are not important anymore. But it occurs in the following context. A debate where Lenin's group, the Bolsheviks, are reuniting with the group they split from 1903, the Mensheviks. There's a party congress, and Lenin, in the congress, is arguing the following things. He's calling it democratic centralism. He says that he complains, we still have work to be done to apply the principles of democratic centralism to party organization. What does that mean? To work tirelessly to make the local organizations the principal organizational units of the party, in fact, and not merely in name, and to see to it that all the higher standing bodies are elected, accountable, and subject to recall. That's extraordinary. The term democratic centralism is usually associated with Leninists who argue for a centralized, disciplined, top-down hierarchy of the party. Here, the term emerges in history for the first time from Lenin, and what's he arguing for? He's saying the local, not the top, not the central committee, not the full-timers, the local organizations have to be autonomous, in fact, not in theory. In fact, the officials have to be elected, all of them, not appointed, elected, and recallable. This is how he's arguing for it. I didn't know this. I knew that there was a debate about Lenin until I started studying this talk, because you get thinking. Movements are wonderful things. It gets you thinking about things you haven't thought about in a long time. What's the context? Now, how do you explain this contradiction? This is 1906. Between 1903, when Lenin wrote What Is to Be Done, and 1906, an extraordinary thing had happened. It was the first Russian Revolution, 1905, which is where the working class of Russia invented the Soviet, the Workers' Council, a mass upsurge against Tsarism, a huge explosion. Hundreds of thousands of people moving into the streets, millions moving into political activity, peasants seizing the land, a huge movement shaking all of Russian society. The context shapes very profoundly the type of party organization that Lenin argued for. In 1903, 1902, 1901, 1900, when Marxists were organizing in Russia, when you set out on your career as a Marxist organizer, that career, on average, lasted 3 months before you were arrested and sent to Siberia. That was the context. It was a dictatorship. It was a repressive dictatorship. The police agents were everywhere. Every meeting of your cell, there would be a police agent present. Every journal was infiltrated. They would infiltrate things, expose them, send people to jail. It was an extraordinarily difficult place to organize. It would be similar to organizing today in Egypt, where some comrades were just for at the Cairo conference. It's a very, very difficult circumstance. That's the context in which Lenin was very insistent. He says, why did he say the party has to be mostly professional revolutionaries? It wasn't entirely professional, but they have to be the core. He says, because otherwise everyone will get arrested. We have to. Why should we be very, very strict about discipline? We have to be very careful about who we meet and when we meet with them, because we're always being infiltrated. We have to try to prove, if we don't have some type of a very centralized operation, the party will simply not exist. It will disappear very quickly. He was responding to a set of facts that were real in society. That context changed completely in 1905 when the revolution happened, when Soviets were across the workers' councils, when workers themselves were moving in their millions. It changed completely. Now, if this didn't change the ideas of the Bolsheviks all at once, there was an extraordinary moment where there was a party congress of the Bolsheviks in 1905. Lenin got up and said, we have to open the gates of the party. The working class is spontaneously Marxist. In 1903, he had written, the working class can only aspire to trade union consciousness. Marxism comes to the working class from the outside. It's bourgeois intellectuals who break from the bourgeoisie. We learn Marxism, then we go and we teach the workers. That's crude. He didn't really say that, but we'll take that caricature, fine. It's close enough. It's actually Karl Kautsky who said that. And Lenin was quoting him. Doesn't matter. Karl Kautsky's a social democrat. We understand it's top down. 1905, he says, working class is spontaneously Marxist. Open the gates of the party. Bring them in. We want to expand the Central Committee. 100 people. Bring all workers onto the Central Committee. We need, and his own members were shocked. The professional revolutionaries who had been hired in 1903, 1904 said, what are you talking about? That's not how the party is. The party is centralized. A party is the professional revolutionaries. We can't. The working class is too backward to be brought in. I know this because I read Lenin. I read What Is to Be Done, and they were quoting Lenin. And Lenin says, ah, what is to be done? Whatever. You know? The context has changed. It's different. You know, we need something different. In 1906, he's deepening and extending that. The revolutionary wave is still ongoing. In retrospect, it's probably the case that the revolutionary wave had ebbed by then, but they were operating as if it had. And in so it's the first moment when any of these Marxists have operated in conditions where there's much less repression. The movement of the masses into history has held back the hand of the state, has made it possible to be above ground, possible to do things. I mean, I understand you sell, people in the IS here sell in the paper outside the Tory building. You should sell in the Tory building just for the selling a socialist paper in the Tory building. It sounds good, you know. But that type of activity couldn't happen in 1903. You had to circulate the paper secretly. Here, take a copy, you pass it on, that type of thing. Now they can do it openly for the first time. In that context, he said, it's like a breath of fresh air. He says, democracy, local autonomy, deepen things, elect the officials. We're not going to appoint people anymore. If you can't get elected from your local group, to hell with you. You have to be elected. If you're not elected, it doesn't matter, etc. A sense of a deep democracy inside the party. Now, this brief moment of openness didn't last. By 1908, the Tsar had reasserted control. A terrible, terrible reaction set in. Siberian camps were full again as people went into exile in Siberia. The party was reduced. The party had grown to 40, 50, 60, 70,000 people in that period of time. It was reduced to maybe 800 at one point. A very, very a huge reaction, a huge catastrophic collapse of the party, in which case these ideas, he returns to the notion of professional revolutionaries, of a tightly organized party, etc. But I think the reasons are contextual. I think that this is I think that we have to, in other words, situate Lenin's ideas on party organization in the context in which they developed, and for that brief moment where there was a possibility of opening, building in an open and above-ground way, democratic centralism looks very different than the way in which it has been transmitted down through the ages. Now, what about the state? It's true that by 1922, the great dreams of the workers' state that had emerged in 1917 seemed to be at an impasse. There were problems. It was now a one-party state. Parties were banned. The Mensheviks, their opponents, were banned. It wasn't just bourgeois parties. Left-wing parties were banned. The Menshevik Party had been banned. Another group, the Socialist Revolutionary Party, had been banned. The anarchists, many of them had been spending some time in prison, in another prison. There were no factions allowed in the Bolshevik Party. Bolshevik Party had ended its factions. The Soviets were essentially a dead letter. The workers' councils, they were not meeting, or if they met, it was formal. It was, you know, those meetings you go to where it's formally democratic, but you know that the head of the department is going to make all the decisions at the end of the day. You just sit around and, you know, whatever. Yeah, go on your way. It's really just etc. And that problem of a state that doesn't look democratic anymore seems to be the legacy of Lenin. But let's look more closely at Lenin's notion of the state as it developed. You have to start with 1914. In 1914, the year that World War I began, in August of 1914, the social democratic parties across the world, almost all of them, went to war. They voted for the war, including the biggest one, the most German social democratic party, to call itself Marxist, voted for the war. France and Canada actually didn't. In Canada, there were two socialist parties that didn't vote for the war. It's very interesting. And good for them. It was a huge betrayal. It surprised everyone. It surprised Lenin. When Lenin saw the announcement that the German Social Democratic Party had voted for the war, he thought it was a forgery. He says, this cannot be true. The party of Karl Marx in Germany cannot be supporting the slaughter, sending German workers to kill French workers. He can't. But it was true. And it began a process where Lenin began to rethink. He says, I think there's a problem at the core of Marxism. He identified several. One of them, he says, is the notion of the state. Essentially, he said, the social democratic parties in the big bourgeois countries have developed the illusion that they can take over the already existing, very sophisticated state machine as the party, take that machine over, give it a left coloration, that'll be socialism. He says, that's an illusion. That will not happen. And in their desperation to preserve, you know, if you were to vote against the war in Germany in 1914, any chance you had of taking over that state is gone. You're going to be stripped of your offices, parties will be declared illegal, lose your fund, lose your money, etc., driven underground, etc. In clinging on to the state, they went so far as to preserve their relationship with the state, they went so far as to be able to counsel sending millions of workers to their death in war. That's the first notion. This culminates then in a book that he writes in 1917, an amazing book called State and Revolution, where he's writing it in exile. He writes it between February and October. So February of 1917 is the first upsurge, the overthrow of the Tsar. There's a very, very complicated period, series of events, of very tense and profoundly historic events in the subsequent months. At one moment, the Bolsheviks are driven underground again. Lenin's in exile in Finland. He's sitting on a stump writing this book. He says to his collaborators, and if I'm killed or something happens to me, one thing I want to make sure, this book has to get printed. Because he saw this book as finishing his critique with German social democracy. And what did this book say about the state? It said, the new state, the worker state, to replace capitalism, had to look the following way. He says, first of all, he had a critique of the capitalist state. He says, to decide once every few years which member of the ruling class is to repress and crush the people through parliament, this is the real essence of bourgeois parliamentarianism. You know, Bush or Kerry, Charest or what's his name?
Landry,
yes. Harper, or we've got the corrupt Paul Martin, so we're going to get rid of him, and we're going to get Stephen Harper. I mean, my God. Not only in parliamentary constitutional monarchies, but also in the most democratic republics. What follows from this? The state cannot be taken over. It necessarily follows that the revolution must pursue the aim not of improving the state machine, but of smashing and destroying it. Smashing and destroying not just to leave nothing, but to replace it with a worker state. What did he mean by the worker state? It has to be democracy for the vast majority of the people. It has to be a state which will tend to wither away. Here's what he meant by that. He said, he's a realist. He says, essentially a state is an institution of force. It's an institution that has historically been used by a minority to enforce their rule over the majority. In a capitalist society, the state is the state of the rich. It's the state of the corporations that uses force to rule over the majority. The worker state will still be a state of force, but it will be the force of the vast majority, the 90-95% of the population who are workers and peasants and poor and urban poor and unemployed, enforcing their will over the rich, who they've taken their property from, who they've taken. That means it will tend to wither away, because as we deal with the problem of the existing rich, as we deal with that problem, there will be no longer a need for a state. It's a remarkable document. He was accused of being an anarchist. You know, people in the left read this, they said, this is not Marxism, this is anarchism. What are you talking about? And he says, fine, whatever, call me what you want. He says, in fact, sometimes he said at one point in 1917, he says, I prefer the anarchists to the old social democrats. The old social democrats are so wedded to the state, I don't know if they'll ever change, but at least the anarchists, I've got arguments with them, but at least they want to rip the head off the system. So good, you know, we could work with that. Why was he writing something like this? Because what was happening, I've described briefly what happened in February 1917, what was happening across Russia in the wake when the poor and the workers emerged onto the stage of history? What a remarkable thing that was. There were, and the idea of workers and peasants organizing in their own fora was not just verbal, it was taken up everywhere. There were councils, there were factory committees in the factories, not called by any party. These were created by the workers themselves. There were Soviets everywhere. A section of St. Petersburg, the four each had their own Soviets. There was one set of Soviet for the city as a whole. People got in the habit that anything that you were organizing, you organized collectively. If you had a housing estate, you had a problem, create a housing estate council, solve the problem. If you have a neighborhood and there's a problem in terms of the parks, that you form a neighborhood council, solve the problem. There's a story by a Belgian socialist who was in Russia as a diplomat. He was traveling from Petrograd to Moscow by train, and it was a very slow train. And the people were very upset that it was going so slowly. So the people who were sharing his compartment formed a traveling committee in order to feel how to deal with the situation before they reach their destination. It's wonderful. It's happened everywhere. There's a huge explosion of workers' democracy. And this was the context in which he was writing. He could see the possibility of a real democracy from below. Now, what happened to that? What happened to that moment of incredible, intense democracy at the underpinning of the worker state? Usually the argument is that it was Lenin's ideas and Lenin's Bolshevik Party. When they finally got on top, they strangled it. It's not true. It's way too simplistic. Well, the concrete situation in which the Russian Revolution happened was one of extreme desperation. This is a very poor society. This is a society, the modern day equivalent would be a little more than Mozambique. Some combination between Mozambique and Brazil, perhaps. Sao Paulo and Brazil, a very, very poor society. The revolution was met immediately by a blockade of the major powers, the way the U.S. is blockading Cuba right now. The peace treaty, the Russian worker state ended the war. The German state wouldn't end it right away. The German state, the final peace settlement cut the Ukraine off from Russia. The impact of that in Russia was devastating because the Ukraine was the breadbasket of Russia. The people started to starve. There was that catastrophic collapse of industry. Most of the industry had been oriented. What does capitalist society do? Capitalist society organizes industry to create arms. The war was over. The arms industries collapsed. The population of St. Petersburg, in a 1 year between 1917 when the revolution happened and 1918, 1 year later, its population went down by 1.5 million. As people left, people lost their jobs, they went back to the countryside. The population of Moscow went down by 1 million. The loss of Ukraine, and then the next part of the thing was civil war. Army after army after army that had been fighting each other in World War I united against the Russian worker state to invade it and destroy it. The combination of catastrophic economic collapse, the loss of the Ukraine, the civil war, meant famine. 2.5 million people dying of famine in a 4 or 5 year period of time. Now, by 1922, they had won. The civil war was over. They had won the civil war. They had restabilized, to a certain extent, the Russian economy. But the cost had been catastrophic. The working class, which had been at the core of the workers' councils movement, had been decimated, partly physically, by hunger and privation, partly by disappearing into the countryside as peasantry, in large measure because they were the people to defend the revolution who had volunteered for the Red Army to fight against the Contras and had died in their tens and tens of thousands. That is the context in which all of the measures occurred. And in a civil war is a very difficult thing. Why were the social revolutionaries banned? Because they were actively organizing in a way on the side of the right wing. There was an assassination attempt on Lenin, for instance, that was part of that, organized by a left-wing group. I think that there were some mistakes made. I think that, personally, Marshall Lehman makes this point in this book. He says the banning of the Mensheviks was probably wrong. I think that that's an interesting point, an interesting argument, etc. But in the point to make about this is that that's not the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing that transformed the democratic content of the Russian Revolution was not the policies of the Bolsheviks. The fundamental thing was the civil war. The famine, the blockade, the hunger, the starvation, the privation, the deaths, etc. Okay. What does this mean for us today in the last 5 minutes? Okay. In 1922, I think it was, there was an organization had been created, inspired by the Russian Revolution, called the Communist International. And it, in 1922, published a set of theses called organizational theses, recommending to socialists around the world how they should organize. Lenin, by this time, was a very sick man. He had had a stroke, and he was about to have another one. He could barely work. He could, at this moment in time, he could still talk and write a little bit. One of the last things he wrote was a critique of this organizational statement. He says, look, it's got 51 points. He says, I agree with every one of the 51 points. He says, but I'm afraid that this might become a millstone around our neck. I'm afraid that this document might be a huge barrier to our building in the West. He says, it's too Russian. It speaks too much to the Russian experience. It's understandable. We are the ones who've made a revolution. The other people look to us, but it's too Russian. What did he mean by this? Think back to the story that I've told, where The vast majority of the experience of the Russian left, the Bolsheviks included, is one of building underground, of building in conditions of extreme repression, of building in conditions where you can't sell a paper openly, where it's very difficult to stand for elections, where there's no legal trade unions, or where they're legal, they're probably partly legal, etc., and all the rest of it. In Western Europe, where the bulk of the Communist International was at the time, those conditions did not prevail. In Western Europe, it was conditions where you could sell the paper openly. There was repression, there were the cops and all the rest of it, nothing like Russian conditions. There was bourgeois democracy. There was existing openly. Lenin is saying here, he's saying, you are taking the 90% of our experience where we had to build underground and assuming that that's the norm for advanced capitalist countries. Actually, it's the two-year period of time, 1905, 1906, 1907, where we could build above ground. That's the one you should be looking at. That moment in time where it was build deep into localities, elective principle inside the party, and all the rest of it. Why is that important? One thing that Lenin said, he says, it's the great prejudice of Bolshevism that if you want to learn how to ride a horse, you have to get on its back. A local socialist organization cannot figure out how to take the next step, how to do things, without doing it. You can't, and to do that, there has to be a deep amount of democracy, there has to be a deep amount of scope for making mistakes. In studying Lenin, in other words, and I have no idea whether I've answered the question, Lenin dictator or Democrat, we can get into that discussion, but the point I want to make from this is in studying Lenin, like studying everything, we have to separate the essential from the contingent. If in terms of party organization, what's the essential? The essential is there were some things that are unbelievably important. Look, there are certain advantages to building a bourgeois democracy like Canada. I've just described it. We could build openly. There are certain disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is you can go to sleep. It can seem like capitalism's forever. It can seem like everything's fine. I can just have a nice, quiet life. Everything's okay. Gotta go. Everything's fine. Things can seem fine for years, for decades, for generations. And all of a sudden, it catches you by surprise when capitalism goes into a catastrophic crisis. Growing up in Russia, you knew that there was a catastrophic crisis because it was a catastrophic crisis every day of the week. It's like building in Mexico right now. You can feel the crisis in your gut. You can feel it exactly. This is an essential lesson from Lenin, that even in quiet times, even in a bourgeois democracy, it's important for the revolutionaries to organize separately. That's an essential part of the... Another essential part is the United Front method, that let's escape from the sterile choice between I'm going to be a leftist and irrelevant, or I'm going to be a reformist and sell out my principles, but at least I'll be relevant. No, we don't have to have that sterile choice. We can be very left-wing, and we have to be left-wing because capitalism requires it. That system will not go away without a revolution, but we can be very relevant by linking up to the real struggles of the day, working with people who don't agree with us, but who agree that the war should be stopped, who agree that we need better wages, who agree that we need women's rights, etc. That is an essential lesson. The other ones are contingent. Sometimes a party has to organize in a very, very, very tight manner. If we are driven underground, that will have to happen. But on other occasions, when you can be open, when you can have many local groups, when you can reach deep into localities, then you should do that. Separate the essential from the contingent. In terms of the state, I won't say more about that. But I won't say anything more about that. But I think that the moment of 1917 to about March, April 1918 is a moment that we all should study in terms of the possibility of real workers' power from below. Those are the points I'd like to make. I think that there is a new left today for whom there is a... Whether or not we agree on this interpretation of Lenin, it's really not important. In a certain sense, we should have debate back and forth. We need to study. We need to look at the lessons from the past. Look at the way in which revolutionaries in the past have attempted to try and organize and overthrow capitalism and deal with it, because we are faced today with a terrible situation. Capitalism is once again sending its economies into mortal competition, leading to military competition, leading to wars and disasters. It's also a very wonderful moment because there's a new left emerging of literally millions of people who are looking for ways to organize against that. And it's our responsibility to learn from the lessons of the past in order to apply them for the present, for the tasks that will be posed in the future. So I'll leave it at that.